I want to stress from the outset that this pandemic is far from over.
This is all about trust now and personal responsibility and just being careful and not being selfish.
We need people to have faith that this vaccine is safe and that they should take it.
The idea of an irreversible move was taken off the table. You can't do that when you have no idea where the virus is going to go.
Hello, you're listening to Bloomberg Westminster, your daily guide to British politics. I'm Roger Hearing.
Good afternoon, I'm Ewan Potts. The UK is set to allow visitors from the US and the EU to travel to England without needing to quarantine if they've been fully vaccinated. Boris Johnson and the Cabinet are due to discuss and finalise the details at a meeting later today.
Well, the plan would allow Americans and EU citizens to enter the UK on the same basis as Britons who've had two jabs. That means they can take tests and show proof of vaccination instead of having to self-isolate for 10 days. If it proceeds as expected, it may deliver a significant boost to the aviation and travel sector.
In Brexit news, the EU has backed off the threat of imminent legal action against the EU over breaches of the Northern Ireland Protocol as the two sides try to work through their differences. The delay in action comes after EU ambassadors were told last week that the bloc was planning to take action this month.
Well, Bloomberg's been told that officials from both sides will be talking during the summer to look for technical solutions to the Brexit deal on Northern Ireland, but it is unlikely all the issues can be resolved, and the EU insists the deal cannot be renegotiated.
Well, let's get more on all of this and the other big political issues of the day with Christine Jardine. She's the Liberal Democrats' Treasury spokesperson and MP for Edinburgh West. Thanks so much for joining us on Bloomberg Westminster. Christine, now a fair amount of criticism at the time, but given the rapidly falling infection numbers we've seen this week, it's looking like the government's decision to roll back restrictions on our freedoms is actually looking quite well timed.
Good morning. You know, it's rolling back, but we are being warned all the time by scientists and by medical people that we should be looking much deeper into these figures, that they don't always include reinfections, people who've had COVID-19 before and are getting reinfected. And we've still to get the effect of the opening up from 2 weeks ago. But for me, what is the most worrying thing about this is the government is experimenting with people's lives. They don't actually know what the impact is going to be. And the plans to ease all restrictions at once, including the mandatory mask rule, is reckless. When cases were soaring, you know, the peak in new cases is not expected until the end of August. And parents will still be worried about, you know, are schools going to reopen in September? And, you know, we've got big concerns that the government push to remove all restrictions has been driven more by internal battles within the Conservative Party rather than sound scientific advice and looking at the long-term impact. Remember, figures fell last summer, and last summer we didn't build on that. We didn't take the right steps. What we need is more test and trace, more test and track, to be more efficient. We need more ventilation for businesses, and we need to be looking at how we support people through this final stage that we hope will get us onto a solid footing and not in September whip the carpet out from under businesses with the end of furlough completely, but without knowing where we're going.
But what about the issue of vaccine passports? Because to some that seems the imposition of a further restriction. Many businesses have been very unhappy about it. And we even had the Conservative MP Andrew Bridgen on yesterday saying, and he's obviously on the Tory benches, and you talk about this as possibly being a division inside the governing party. He says domestic vaccine passports are unacceptable. He'd vote against them every day of the week. Which side will you be going into in terms of going into the lobbies if this comes to a vote?
Well, here's the funny thing. I'll probably be voting the same way as Andrew Bridgen, because I think if this comes to a vote, that, I mean, what they're calling vaccine passports are actually ID cards, and there's something which is unworkable. It's not, the industry doesn't want it because it's unworkable. It's more red tape. It doesn't protect anybody. Double vaccinations, you are told. Those of us who are fortunate enough to already be double vaccinated know that when you have that second vaccination, they warn you that you will not be immune to COVID-19. You will have more protection, but you can still get it and you can still carry it. You can still infect other people. So we need to continue to be careful. But to have vaccine passports, as they're calling them, which say, well, if you've had your double injections, you can go into a nightclub, is reckless because, A, you're not allowing for the fact that people could still be infectious, because we all need to keep having lateral flow tests and tests to make sure that we are negative, but also it's divisive. Because there will be people who haven't had double vaccines through no fault of their own. The 500,000 people in this country who are immunosuppressed. There are all the people, the young people who have not yet qualified for double vaccines. You will have to prove it. And how do you go about proving it? You have all the bureaucracy. It's expensive for nightclubs. What they need is better ventilation and better track and trace. These are the things that the government should be doing. Not just coming up with, you know, a vaccine passport, which nobody apart from a certain group within the Conservative Party thinks is a good idea.
Mm. Has Nicola Sturgeon done a better job of dealing with the pandemic?
No, absolutely not. You know, when you live in Scotland, you get frustrated by the fact that the SNP has this wonderful spin machine. That's the one thing they are better at. They're better at presenting the message. And Nicola herself, personally, has done a very, very much better job than perhaps Boris personally in projecting what the government's doing and presenting what they're doing to you know, the public. But actually, when you drill down into it, no, we're no better off. And Scotland has had, you know, some of the worst infection rates in Europe, and you know, our care homes were an absolute scandal at the beginning of this. The number of deaths that we had in care homes in Scotland. The vaccine rollout programme hasn't been as successful in Scotland. So, I mean, we do get a bit frustrated in Scotland at this constant claim by the SNP that, oh, well, we are doing better than the rest of the UK. No, they're not. Yeah. And you know what? It's not a competition. It should be about people's lives. It should be about looking after the population the best you can and not trying to say, oh, you're doing better than any other part of the world. It should be about the people for whom the government is responsible.
Well, Christine, it's been interesting, obviously, that the government has come up, it seems, or briefing, that they've come up with this idea that EU and US citizens who are double jabbed should be able now to have slightly different way of coming back into the UK. They wouldn't have to self-isolate. There'd be a system of tests and proving vaccination. And many people would see that as a way forward, perhaps, for the travel hospitality sector at a time when it's under enormous stress. It only applies to England, of course, though whether how you'd police it going across the borders is an interesting question. What do you think of it?
Well, I mean, that is a very interesting question. You know, people fly into Newcastle. Where are they going to go? People fly into Manchester. That is one of the imponderables. I think that the travel industry and the tourist industry in this, they have been so badly hit. They need some assurances. But what the worry about this is going to be yet another of Boris's U-turns coming up. You know, he comes up with this plan today. How do we know that's going to be his plan next week? We've had no certainty, no clarity, no continuity of thought or purpose. Everything is, you know, self-contradictory. I mean, if you look at the situation in the United States at the moment, we hear that they are worried about the rapid spread of the Delta variant of COVID-19, that some states are thinking about mandatory vaccines. And, you know, there's a huge controversy in the states at the moment because they are now feeling the impact of the Delta vaccine. Now, we saw that the government didn't act quickly enough when we realised that India was going through a terrible time, that our government didn't act quickly enough. I just hope that they've done the research this time and that, A, they're going to be consistent, and, B, that we're not going to get a turnaround in 2 weeks' time, which just messes the travel industry up yet again, because that's what they've had throughout this, is, you know, one decision 1 week and one decision 2 weeks later. It's time that we had some consistency and some transparency and some support for the travel industry through this. They haven't had support which is appropriate specifically for them. You know, they're having to book holidays a couple of months down the line. They don't get paid until those holidays are actually taken, and you know, that is for them, there's a massive cash flow problem. And we see furlough being eased out now, so you know, we are all hoping that the government has a strategy, a long-term strategy for this, and I hope that, you know, at some point we begin to see the beginning of it.
I want to get your thoughts on another big issue at the moment. Your campaign against planning reform and against more house building was a great success for you in Chesham and Amersham in that by-election. Are you happy selling that position to younger voters who can't afford a flat?
What was a huge success for us in Chesham and Amersham was the fact that we listened to the people in that constituency who were being ignored by the Conservatives. That is what was a huge success for us in Chesham and Amersham. People felt abandoned there, that they weren't being listened to. Planning regulations need to be appropriate for the area, and we do need more housing, and we need to build housing where it's going to be affordable, where it's appropriate. But you have to take cognizance of the local community's needs. And that is what I think the Conservatives are getting wrong at the moment. They are not listening to the communities. You know, do I have sympathy with young people trying to buy the home? I've got a daughter who's a young person looking to buy her first house at the moment. And it's difficult out there. And this is a problem that is not, has not, you know, arrived on us suddenly. This is a problem which developed from the 1980s when we sold off a lot of the council house stock and didn't replace it. And yes, it was absolutely brilliant that people were able to buy their own homes, but we didn't have a long-term strategy for ensuring that we had enough houses for every section of the population, that housing was available. And the one phrase I hate more than any other is affordable housing, because all housing should be affordable.
Let's have a look at what else is making news in the world of politics today.
Labour says that flexible working should become the new normal after the experience during the coronavirus pandemic. The party is calling for the right to flexible work in all jobs. Deputy Leader Angela Rayner says that the concept is not just about allowing people to work from home, but also includes flexible, compressed and staggered or annualised hours. The idea is to allow people to spend less time commuting and more time with their families in future.
Now, nurses say there's going to be a summer of action to demand an increase to the proposed 3% pay rise for NHS staff. The Royal College of Nursing says it's going to hold demonstrations throughout the UK. It's been calling for a 12.5% wage rise and says the government's offer will lead to many people leaving the profession. The RCN said a poll it commissioned found a majority of the public think the 3% pay award is too little. 62% think there are too few nurses to provide safe care to patients.
Around a third of middle-aged people have chronic health issues. That comes from a survey that's been tracking the lives of about 17,000 Britons born in a single week in 1970. The latest report published in the BMC Public Health Journal says that 34% had two or more chronic health problems, such as high blood pressure and mental ill health, at age 46 to 48. The most commonly reported problems also included high-risk drinking and recurrent back problems. Arthritis, diabetes and asthma also featured on the list.
Rather grim, that. Well, anyway, let's talk about the environment. As the COP26 climate summit approaches, one of the key issues is how do we use land? How do we reduce the human impact on the surface of the planet with an eye to ameliorating the effects that are accelerating global warming? Also, how do we in the UK address the effects of intensive farming in reducing biodiversity or changing our ecology? Well, about 60 years ago, a fascinating experiment began in Cambridgeshire at a place called Monk's Wood. There was an area of land which they just decided to leave alone, completely alone, and see what happened. Well, the Monk's Wood Wilderness Experiment was a rewilding study before the term even existed, and it shows how allowing land to naturally regenerate can expand native woodland and help tackle climate change and biodiversity loss. Well, very pleased to say that joining us now is Dr. Richard Broughton, who's with the UK Centre for Ecology and Hydrology. He's made a study of what happened at Monk's Wood and what we can learn. Dr. Broughton, thanks for being with us. First of all, just walk us through what happened, or I suppose in a way what didn't happen and the consequences.
Yeah, good morning. Well, what happened is there was a field of barley and then a field of grassland for hay. And what happened is we just decided to do nothing to it, to examine what would happen if we just left it alone. We walked away and abandoned it, but we monitored it. This is the key thing. Abandoned land usually gets abandoned because people have walked away, but we just stood back and then we watched what happened. And we monitored it over 25 years for one plot and 60 years for another plot. And we saw what it turned into. And in the end, it turned into woodland.
And just talk us through what exactly it looks like. How has it developed over those years? How have the two plots changed?
Yeah, so for the first 10 to 15 years, first of all, it becomes grassy, and then we get a thicket of shrubs and brambles, and this becomes really impenetrable. After about 10 years, you cannot walk through it. This is why we called it the wilderness. It's like a tongue-in-cheek joke that you just couldn't get in there anymore. So for 10 years, you just have to stand back and observe it, what goes on. But after about 20 years, the trees start poking up above the thickets, and then after 40 to 50 years, it's basically mature woodland, and you can't tell it apart from woodland, which has been there for much longer.
But how biodiverse is it? Because we live in a country where many species have been introduced, of course, both animal and vegetable. Do they get pushed out? Does it grow back to what it was in the indigenous species, or does it just absorb everything?
Well, it goes through several stages. So you have the initial shrubland stage, and this is kind of the most controversial stage because it's what we used to call scrub. You know, people see long grass and brambles, and they think, "Oh, this looks very untidy." But this is the essential first stage, which is the nursery for the tree saplings. All of these thorn thickets protect the tree seedlings as they're growing from deer. So we didn't need any fencing, we didn't need any tree tubes to protect the trees because the brambles and the thorns were protecting it. And for about the first 20 years, this shrubland is a really fantastic habitat. It's full of wildflowers, it's full of blossom, and it's full of butterflies and pollinators. So it's really essential first stage. Then as the woodland then matures, it becomes a structurally complex native woodland. This is how it differs from planting, because you have these multiple layers of vegetation in there. You have the understory of the thickets, and then you have the tree canopy above it. So you have a very rich, complex habitat.
How much of a surprise is this? Haven't we always been told in the past that you can't just leave land? You know, it becomes too much of a mess, and you have to look after the land and sort of manage nature. Isn't that the conventional thinking on this?
Well, this is the surprising thing. You know, anyone with a garden knows that if you don't do something for a while, you start getting seedlings popping up which you didn't plant. And the big gap in the knowledge is no one's actually done this on any kind of scale for a very long time, you know, over a long time period. So there isn't much information about what you do actually get if you just walk away for a long period. So the surprise was really how quickly it developed, and also the composition of it as well. So we have an ancient woodland next door which provides all of the seed sources. It's got the woodland wildlife in there already. But we found that the new woodland wasn't exactly the same as the old woodland next door. It was biased towards trees and seeds and bushes which had been planted by birds. So things like oak especially. So the woodland next door is only about 20% oak, but in the new woodland it's more than 50% oak woodland because it's been planted by jays. So this is the big surprise. It's how the animals and the birds engineer the new habitat.
What sort of animals do you get in there? I mean, again, do you get invasive species like grey squirrel, or do you tend to get more of what we think of as native species?
Well, it's funny you mentioned grey squirrel. Nobody really likes grey squirrels, but we think they might have been planting some of the acorns too, so they're actually engineering some of the habitat too, we think. But no, it's dominated by native species. It's a native woodland, and we've got purple hairstreak butterflies moving in. We've now got marshes moving in. These are ancient woodland specialists which are moving into this new habitat.
What sort of scale are we talking about here in this experiment, and could you see this being rolled out at a greater scale?
Yeah, so rewilding, we tend to think of very large scale, you know, huge estates like NEP with great big landscape scale processes. This was small scale. This was a couple of fields, so just a couple of typical fields, 10 hectares, or 4 hectares or 10 acres in old money. But this kind of small-scale rewilding is probably more doable for many landowners across the country. If they just want to expand their woods, you're not going to rewild your whole estate. You probably only want to do a couple of fields. And this shows that you can do it really quickly and get very good results.
Let me ask you sort of about the wider conclusions of this, because I think a lot of people will be listening and thinking, well, yeah, it's interesting, but what you're doing in this way is taking land away from human beings. I mean, it's effectively useless to humans now. Isn't it better perhaps to move towards seeing how we can farm land, but farm it in an eco-friendly manner rather than just letting it go to waste?
You say waste, but one of the objectives of COP26 is to restore habitats and protect habitats, and this is what this is doing. Land on the edge of woodlands, it's often quite marginal. The woodlands have only survived because it's very marginal land, so the land next to them is often only marginal land. So if we're intensively farming the good land, we can then maybe offset the marginal land next to the woods and let them expand a bit more. And also, you know, we get the benefits from it. We restore biodiversity. These are really nice places to be. They're very cool in the summer. You know, they're very resilient to flooding and droughts. And they restore the habitats. And we also get carbon locking up there too. So native woodland, it's the second most valuable habitat for capturing carbon and then storing carbon. Next to peat bogs, it's the best habitat you can have. So if we want to offset carbon emissions, native woodland is the thing to do.
How much awareness do you think there is amongst farmers and landowners of the benefits of doing something like this? Is this really kind of quite cutting edge? Are there many people sort of doing this kind of thing?
Well, landowners have been penalised for letting land, you know, go its own way. They get penalised for scrub, or they have been previously. And the attitudes are changing, and DEFRA is looking at rewarding farmers, actually, and giving grants to expand woodland in this way, using natural regeneration, basically rewilding on a smaller scale. We could be more ambitious about this, but, yeah, we do need to change attitudes. You know, we need to start thinking of these habitats as really, really valuable.
Richard, that's an interesting point you made, that it's valuable. I mean, if you're thinking about the gathering of COP26, of course, that's coming up and all the people getting together and thinking about these things, including what you're talking about, I suppose, how we use land and how it can be a benefit to us in not obvious ways, what would you say to them? What would be your message from what you've learned from this?
Change perceptions, challenge perceptions, be ambitious as well. We can do lots of small-scale rewilding like this, and it will all add up. You know, England's got lots of patchy, fragmented woodland. It's one of the most deforested parts of Europe. We've only got a third of the European average of woodland. But all our woodland is in tiny little patches all over the place. And we could expand lots of these onto a few fields nearby, and that would really add up. So, yeah, it would just be change perceptions of what we do want for a good habitat. What is nature restoration? What does it look like? We don't have to engineer everything ourselves. We can actually let some of it just restore itself, and it will do that.
And with leaving the European Union, as you say, DEFRA is moving towards shaping the way we want to manage agriculture in this country. What would you like to see from the government to encourage more of this over the coming years and decades?
I think just to be more ambitious, like I said, so we have the England Tree Strategy, which is it's come out recently. This has natural regeneration is actually in there as one of the policies. You know, they're starting to look at this more seriously. But it's constrained at the moment. You know, it's within very limited circumstances. But I think we could be a lot more ambitious, and we could look at rolling this out, across the country a lot more. We could look at expanding woodland in a planned way.
Bloomberg Westminster. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.